Hello and welcome back to Cooking the Books with me, Jilly Smith, the podcast which takes us through four food moments from the books of our favourite food writers. It's about all of life through the prism of food. And this week I'm with Alexina Anatole to talk about bitter, the least pleasant of our tastes. Or is it?
If sweetness was the only thing we really loved, then white chocolate would be by far the bestseller because it's got no cocoa mass in it, which means it's got no bitterness. White chocolate is just cocoa butter and sweet and sugar and milk. But it's never been the bestseller. Milk chocolate is the bestseller. Why is that? It's because it's got bitter cocoa mass in it.
Her series of cookbooks on the five tastes, bitter, sweet, salty, sour and umami, are a step-by-step exploration of flavour. And an impressive start to what I reckon will be a massive career for this bright young spark who swapped the trading floor for MasterChef in 2020. In the first book, she sets out to tame bitterness, showing us how to soothe it with dairy, balance it with sweetness, and distract it with acidity. But I was more interested in this super-driven polymath of a woman who has everything food TV needs right now. I asked her about that five-book deal.
When I came off of MasterChef, I didn't think that I necessarily wanted to do anything off the back of that. I just had loved the show, loved cooking and thought, great, I'm going to go do that. Didn't really think through the fact it'd be on TV or anything like that, but it was great. And then I came off the show and immediately I knew I wanted to write a book. And at that point, it was like, right, well, what am I going to write about? I knew that I was interested and fascinated in flavour. I knew I'd gone through this journey of teaching myself how to cook for a decade or so, and I'd learned a lot, but there was still so much I wanted to learn. I love books like Nikki Segnit's The Flavour Thesaurus, Salmon Nosrat, Salt for Acid Heat. I love those, the breakdown cooking or flavour. But I thought, I don't think I'm ready to write the final word, like, you know, in the style of Salt for Acid Heat yet. You know, I think there's a lot more I need to learn. How can I go about doing that? And one of the things that came up repeatedly as feedback when I was on MasterChef is they kept talking about my use of bitter and strong flavours. And I suddenly thought to myself, gosh, bitter, that keeps coming up. But no one's really written about that one. Maybe that might be an interesting topic to go and explore. And then, of course, that's one of the five tastes. And I thought, has anyone written a series about the five tastes before? And was in, you know, couldn't believe it hadn't been done. Could not believe it hadn't been done. You've got people who've written sort of about the elements. Mark Diacono has written a brilliant book called Sour. Obviously, Ottolenghi has published a book, Sweet, which is all sort of wonderful baking.
There's lots of people who've done it, but not, as you say, focused
exactly.
on one.
I sort of knew I wanted to write about it, so I started researching, right, how do you write a cookbook proposal? How do you go about this? You know, I had no clue because it was a completely different world where I was before MasterChef. So
tell me briefly about the Penguin deal. Why did they want to do five different books? Was that your idea or was theirs?
It was my idea. Yeah.
Oh, it's what I five book deal straight off.
It's what I pitched because when I thought, well, no one's written about the five tastes, that is such an established framework actually that we're all quite familiar with. We all know, you know, it may be umami slightly less because it's a newer one, but salty, sour, sweet, we know these things. And I think there was something just very powerful about that as a concept. You know, if it hasn't been done before, it works very well as a series. I mean, my publisher, my imprint within Penguin, had great success with Rukmini Iyer's The Roasting Tin series, and they were very much looking for a series. So I think that helps. I also think timing's a huge thing. When you go on something like MasterChef, if you wait until it comes out to sort of go after these things, you've probably missed the boat. Today, everything moves at the speed of light, doesn't it? And so I think one of the best things, I always say one of the best things that happened to me was not winning MasterChef because it ensured I was not complacent at all. I didn't think anyone...
I can't imagine you being complacent about anything.
Nothing was going to land in my lap. That was my assumption, which maybe might have been different had I won it. And so it was as soon as I came off, I thought, right, this is what I want to do. Let me work out what the concept is. And I spent a couple of months forming that, you know, working it in my brain, talking to people, going, well, what about this, structured in this way, and thinking about structure of the book. And then, you know, it was sort of halfway through the MasterChef series that I started reaching out to publishers, but I mean, all really contacts that I had made.
How you write a cookbook is about what you want to say to whom and why. Now, you say, I came off MasterChef and I immediately knew I wanted to write a book. That's an extraordinary thing. What was it about MasterChef that made you think, actually, this is really interesting. It's not that I want to be a chef, which is the route for a lot of people, but I want to write a book. What's the transition from television to writing a book?
That's a very good question. I think that the competition helped me to understand what my specific interests were in food and what my style was. Up until that point, I don't think I knew. I just knew I liked food. I knew I was greedy. I was motivated by food in all sort of areas of my life. But being on the competition and you start to have to, it's rigorous. You're constantly developing recipes. You've got briefs to kind of respond to. And suddenly I started to see that there was a pattern in what I was doing, and I'd never noticed that before. So that's when I started to think about, I realized I had a philosophy of food that I wasn't aware of before. So I think, you know, the difference between good and great food is dimension. How do you add dimension to food? And it can be in so many different ways. It can be through time, is, you know, such a wonderful ingredient in the kitchen for developing flavor over time. And things like memories hold huge power when it comes to how you experience a dish. But a lot of those things are stripped out in a competition. You don't have access. You don't have a limited time. You can't let something slow cook in the oven for 4 hours. You can't ferment something. You don't know the judges. Of course, I didn't know John and Greg prior to being on the show. So I didn't really know what their favorite foods were or what particular things might evoke something for them. So that's how I ended up sort of leaning back on the flavor side of things, on the taste. How am I going to make sure my food has impact in a short space of time with limited resources? It's sort of going more into the bitter, salty, sour flavors. And so that idea that, okay, how do you add dimension to food was interesting to me. And I thought I had something interesting to say about it. So that's kind of where I guess it came.
And presumably they were giving you feedback as well. You were seeing the pattern, but also they were seeing what you were picking up on. I mean, it also says so much about you as a person. This is the first time we've met, but I can see you are somebody who wants to say something, and kind of it doesn't really matter what, but you just want to say something new, which is really important. You're driven. Your background is clearly really interesting because you were born in Brighton, but you moved to Paris as a baby and then you came back to Brixton. So that kind of, I'm very interested in how rupture lights you up. Just take me through that. And what do you know? What do you know now about yourself in terms of somebody who is constantly sort of being open to new experience?
Yes. So I think that's a big part of who I am fundamentally. I've always found belonging to be a tricky thing. Yeah, I'm, as someone who's mixed race, I think that that's inherently a lot of experience for mixed race people, is they sort of belong to two cultures at the same time, but also neither completely. And then, yes, moving to Paris at a young age and being thrown into a different culture, a different language, and having to sort of find my way in that sense has definitely contributed to, I think, the way that I think about food. It's this very sort of broad, in this very broad way, I love it, understanding what food means to different cultures. And I think it comes from a place of trying to understand my own sense of belonging. It comes from a place of trying to find connection. I think food is obviously the great connector. It's a way of sitting and breaking bread with people. It's a powerful, powerful thing. And I think when you feel like you don't belong, there's something that you naturally gravitate towards that. And I think that's certainly the truth for me. And it's why there's quite a lot of broad, I guess, influences in my food.
Yeah.
Because I have just, whether it was growing up in Paris for a period of time and that really formed certain food memories for me, having the Caribbean background, having the background of my maternal grandparents being chicken farmers and that sort of very traditional roasts and making pastry with my grandmother and foraging blackberries in September, you know, at the end of the summer holidays. And then at the same time, going to a very, very mixed state school in South London and experiencing lots and lots of different cultures. In that sense, having friends from lots of different places in the world. And then working at this fishmonger's when I was younger, and it was run by this lady who was Jamaican Miss P, tall, charismatic, most amazing home cook I've ever come across. And she was married to an Italian, she'd lived in Italy and learned. You know, there were just all these sort of threads, I guess, feeding into where I've gone now. And that's also why I decided I wanted to write this series of books, because I didn't want to be tied down to one place. It was important to me to be able to range through different cultures and places, and I felt that this topic would give me the chance to do that. But it was very interesting listening to a couple of weeks ago when you were interviewing Diana Henry, and she was talking about this kind of desire to escape and travel and find meaning in those places. I think I really identified with that.
Well, it's interesting you say that, actually, because, you know, she was an Oxford graduate, you're a Cambridge graduate, you know, both of you are driven by that academic need to question, to really get under the skin of stuff. So you were on the trading floor. You came from a completely different world. Tell me about the financial bit of your brain.
Well, so I think when you're on a trading floor, what that has taught me a lot is resilience. You know, it's a fun but very fast paced, intense place to be, and people are very direct, and so you get used to dealing with that. And I think that's a very good, again, in terms of what you were saying about hustling, and you have to have a thick skin because you're going to get a lot of no's. You're going to get a lot of people who just don't get it, and you've got to keep going, really believe in what you're selling, I guess, and what you believe in ultimately. And so I think that was what I got from a trading floor. I also spent time, I was a strategy consultant at Bain for a period of time as well. And that gave me huge project management structuring sort of skills, which I think have been integral to be me managing this process. You know, creating a book is so much more than just writing a cookbook. You've got to have a whole creative vision. There are a lot of different parts to manage, requires a lot of different skills. And then once the book's out, I mean, you've got to get the word out there. You've got to talk about it incessantly. You've got to get the right people talking about it. It's a huge, huge job. And I think all the things I learned working in the city have given me the skills to be able to manage this process, which is so much more than I have a newfound respect for cookbook authors. I had no concept, as much as I'm a cookbook hoarder and I read cookbooks in bed, but I had no idea how much work it would be. And it's been a real revelation.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we spent a lot of time at the retreats looking at proposals. And breaking your idea down. People think, oh, I want to write a book about this. It's way more than that. You come out with 12-page proposal, you know, with selling points and all sorts of things. But what you're talking about is a vision. What is really interesting is that it's very clear. You use 10 ingredients, presumably in each book. So we're talking about bitter. So you've used 10 ingredients. So that's grapefruit and bitter oranges, bitter greens, tahini, beer. Interesting. We'll talk about that in a second. One of your food moments: walnuts, cranberries, tea, coffee, cocoa. Again, another food moment, and licorice. So the idea of it is to expand our repertoires as cooks. Presumably there were millions more bitter ingredients that you could have chosen from. How did you come down to those?
Well, I think this is an interesting point insofar as when I was really had a lot of time struggling with the structure of the book initially. I couldn't decide whether I wanted, you know, the practical side of me, which comes from, I guess, the trading floor and consulting, was like, oh, well, I think most people cook according to their need in a moment. Or so, oh, I want something for breakfast, I want something for lunch, or I want something for a dinner party. So there was kind of sort of temptation to structure like that. But for this topic, it really felt like the way in was the ingredients, because this is a key point. We think we don't like bitterness. It's something a lot of people, I mean, I was talking to someone just yesterday and they said, oh, I don't like bitter flavours. And then you go, but do you like coffee? Yes. Do you like beer? Yes, I do. Do you like, and then they go, oh, okay, maybe I don't dislike bitterness. Maybe that's a misconception I have. And so that's why the ingredient sort of structure felt really important. And actually it was pretty easy to come up with the ingredients for bitter, because I think, firstly, there were some really, really mainstream ones that were just straight off the bat, immediately, yes, well, coffee, cocoa, beer, those seemed really, really obvious. And then other ones, I guess, were probably influenced by my own personal preferences. I adore grapefruit. I could eat it. I do eat it pretty much every day, actually. And there are certain things like cranberries I think are really underrated, and I wanted to show them off. I wanted people to realize how...
You and Diana Henry both.
Yes. Well, I know exactly. I was listening to that. I was like, yes, absolutely. They're so underrated, and they're used, you know, in America, I guess, where they're grown, they're used a lot more, but here not so much, about other than at Christmas table.
But it is interesting, you say there's this moment between pleasure and disgust, you use, I would call pain, pleasure and pain, that, you know, you describe everything that is bitter. It's kind of that moment of, you know, the wasp in the mouth moment, you know. Why did you choose to start with the least of our favourite tastes?
It's a challenge. I love a challenge.
I'm getting to realise that.
Love a challenge. And I thought what was so interesting about this was I really love bitter flavours. I think loads more people love them than they think. Why aren't we talking about this? Why? That was at the crux of the challenge for me. I really wanted to explore the taste profile that we think we like the least, but it actually is quite mainstream. Some of the most of us drink tea or coffee every single day. Both of these things are bitter. Chocolate, one of the most popular substances on the planet, is bitter, so inherently. And I think that's fascinating. So why have we got this misconception? That was it. It was a question I wanted to answer.
So you use a lot of science. Did you do science at Cambridge? What was your degree?
I read English. Yeah, literature. It just came quite naturally because I was so fascinated by the topic. I really wanted to understand. Because, put it this way, I think what's fascinating is, look, chocolate's a really good thing to think about, right? We've got three types of chocolate that are available. We've got white chocolate, milk chocolate, and dark chocolate. Now, if we just liked sweetness, if sweetness was the only thing we really loved, then white chocolate would be by far the bestseller because it's got no cocoa mass in it, which means it's got no bitterness. White chocolate is just cocoa butter and sweet and sugar and milk. But it's never been the bestseller. Milk chocolate is the bestseller. Why is that? It's because it's got bitter cocoa mass in it. The bitterness is doing something, and it's not that when we eat the milk chocolate, we're getting huge amounts of bitterness from it. But the fact that there's a bitter element is making that more delicious. And that is proven by its commercial success. And actually, the commercial success of chocolate is milk chocolate, then dark chocolate, then white chocolate. So that, to me, is what I'm kind of trying to say in the book. You might think, okay, of course, no, probably few people would want to eat 100% dark chocolate. It is unpalatably bitter. But when it's balanced with the right things, it's the most delicious. There is something about the excitement that it gives our brain when we have something that's not just straightforwardly sweet or perfect or delicious, but has some other quality to it that's intriguing. It excites our brain, it excites our tongue. We have far more receptors on our tongue, different receptors that respond to bitterness than to sweetness, right? So if you can activate more of those receptors, there's more of a party in your mouth. And I think the science for me was trying to understand just why that, how this all works and why that is, without going too far into it. I mean, some of the scientific journals I read were sort of incredibly dense and complicated, and I'm not interested in trying to overwhelm people with information. I just want to give them the key bits that can empower them to understand why something is happening, and that's certainly what I was interested by. So
yeah, absolutely, it adds so much to it. But then of course you bring it all to life with the recipes, and we're going to go through four of your food moments through the recipes. The curry leaf mussels, tell us about this one.
So this curry leaf mussels, I'm very interested in how sort of dishes appear and travel throughout the world. You know, the history of food is the history of people, and it's and how things have migrated, how spices, flavors, etc., have migrated over countries, continents, etc., is fascinating to me. So sometimes when I'm thinking about trying to sort of create something that's a little bit new or different, it for me, that's never about randomly just saying, right, well, I'm going to grab this thing from over here and this flavour from that country. It's always, what's the continued journey of that dish? So I spent sort of summers in the sort of La Rochelle area of France. And around there, you get this dish called mouclade, which is mussels cooked in this lightly spiced kind of curried cream sauce. And that came about because, you know, there were sort of spice trade that came via the port of La Rochelle. And so that's how those spices made their way into that dish. Then I thought to myself, okay, well, if that sort of inspired that way, could you start to take it back? Could you start to take it back towards its root? Let's go back east with this one. So instead of putting cream in there, let's have coconut milk. Instead of, you know, using the local wine or beer, let's try and use a beer that kind of originates in India or Sri Lanka. And I'd been in Sri Lanka last year and fallen newly in love with curry leaves, which has to be one of the most incredible fragrances you can get out there, and really knew I wanted to shower it in curry leaves. And so that's all sort of, you know, how it came, how it kind of came to form into this new dish. And, you know, it works beautifully, and you've got the sweetness of the mussels and the leeks and the coconut milk balanced out with the bitterness of that, of that lager or beer. And it's, yeah, it's a lovely combination.
Yeah. I mean, that one, I really understand. That brings together everything that you've talked about so far and that I've read about you. Rye, pear and maple porridge, your second food moment, doesn't. Do tell us.
It's, I just had to include it because I think it's one of my favourite recipes in the book. And it's something that people kind of go, ooh, what's that? It's quite unusual. There are lots of dishes in the world that are designed to use up stale bread. You've got all the sort of bread salads like panzanella and fattoush and etc. Yeah. And then you've got this wonderful porridge made out of stale rye bread and beer. And I don't personally like beer. So that was interesting when you were, we were talking earlier about which ingredients do you choose. I was trying to choose ones that illustrated the theme as much as possible. So it wasn't just about writing about my own favourites. It was also, and beer is one of those, I don't drink beer. I'm not a beer drinker. I don't particularly enjoy it. So when coming to the beer chapter, that was the sort of, it was a it was an experience of discovery for myself and also a challenge. How can I make sure that beer, I do enjoy these things. And that is one of the dishes that for me is very successful. That beer and the rye bread gives you this kind of slightly salty, sweet, umami, kind of intensely, it's quite an intense porridge. It's not comforting and mild and soft like our classic porridge, but it's so comforting and sort of perfect winter fare. And then you've got this pear and maple and yogurt on top, which I think just brings the balance that you need to make the whole thing sing. By itself, it might be a little bit too intense, but if you get the sweetness of pear and a bit of maple and a slight tang of yogurt, it all just comes into balance. It's beautifully harmonious. And for this time of year, such a gorgeous breakfast.
Juxtaposed with that is your experience, and your third food moment is, which is very French. It was after university that you went back to Paris,
wasn't it?
To work at Galeries Lafayette.
Yes.
Which is Paris's great, wonderful department store. It's sort of Selfridges of Paris, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. I had had this, so throughout my teens, I was obsession with sweetness. I had a real sweet tooth. And as I mentioned before, mixed state school, eating lots and lots of wonderful little, you know, having pastéis de nata and trying gulab jamun and all of those little sugary enchantments. And my latest obsession at that point, at my sort of early 20s, was the French macaron, which was having its moment at that time. And Pierre Amir and La Durée were the big houses doing those exceptionally well. And I had a bit of an obsession with Pierre Amir because he used very interesting flavour combinations. So it was exciting when you're sort of new in food and you're trying to understand different flavours and why they come together. It was quite exciting to get them in these little mini form, in this mini format. So I thought I had my offer to work in on the trading floor, and I decided to defer it for a year because I really wanted to go to Paris and explore this whole sort of pastry and patisserie side of things. So made a beeline for Pierre Amir because I knew I wanted to work for him, and just decided to get a job selling the macaron in the equivalent of our Selfridges. And it was a great experience because I got to eat a lot of macaron. That was really fun. There were ones that would break and you'd put them in the box, and at the end of the day we'd divide them out, and it was brilliant. But it was also, interestingly, the death of my sweet tooth in a way, because after 6 months of having completely overdosed on sugar. I suddenly, gosh, I can't do this anymore. I can't eat another macaron, you know. And that was when I started to sort of look to things like all the cheeses in France and really started to enjoy the salty butter and the bread. And, you know, my kind of salty tooth, my bitter tooth started to develop towards the tail end of that time. There was also this macaron that I tried and remember being blown away by the flavour combination. It's called Mogador, and it was chocolate with passion fruit. And there was something about that combination. It was really playful and harmonious and beautiful and exciting. And it stayed with me, that flavour. When I think in flavour combinations quite a lot. So when I have something, I think, gosh, that just works so beautifully, you know, it just makes immediate sense. I mean, things like mango and lime is another example. You know, you squeeze a lime over mango, fresh mango, it's just unbelievable. And that one, that flavor combination stuck in my head. So it's one that I've played with in different guises over time. I did it on MasterChef. I did a dark chocolate souffle with a very sharp passion fruit sorbet. And again, in the book, I knew I wanted to do it. And I think chocolate tort, flowers chocolate tort, it's been, we've got, there are a million out there. It's a lovely, lovely, delicious thing. But the passion fruit sauce is what just makes it new and fresh and exciting. And when people have it, they seem to love it. So, yeah.
Well, because it feels right. That mm-hmm. feels like that's in my food memory bank. It doesn't feel, a lot of your recipes, I think, oh, that's a bit weird, you know, the grapefruit. Okay, I'll try that. But with that one, I know that one.
Yes.
It feels like with the last two food moments, you are deeply going back to where it all began. And I know that you didn't grow up in St. Lucia. You know, you've never lived in St. Lucia, but it is your family heritage. And your final food moment is the St. Lucia cocoa tea.
The thing I remember most about sort of times when I spent with my grandmother, who's from St. Lucia, well, both my grandparents are from St. Lucia, was very much of very busy family gatherings, a table groaning with food and lots of light and sound. I would remember sort of helping her juice passion fruits to make juice, or making ice cream in one of those old fashioned ice cream turners on the floor. And so it was always a lot of excitement and sort of almost too much food to remember specific details of, you know, there was always so much going on. You're sort of overwhelmed in all the senses. And so going back to St. Lucia as an adult last year felt weirdly like returning home, even though in some ways it was so new to me because I hadn't been as an adult. So I didn't have that kind of reference to it. And I had actually never had cocoa tea before. It's something you get all over St. Lucia. It's really common, but you don't really get it here partly because you can't buy the cocoa sticks. You can get them online nowadays, but you know, they're not available in your supermarket. And it's basically, you know, St. Lucia grows a lot of cocoa because it's got the perfect climate for it. And these cocoa sticks, which they make the cocoa tea with, are compacted cocoa mass. It's very, very bitter. Might have a few spices added in, like some cinnamon or something, but that's basically what it is. And you grate it directly into a pot and you make this spiced stock with like bay leaves and cinnamon and cloves. And then you grate the cocoa tea, the cocoa stick in. It creates this bitter kind of cocoa drink, which you then soothe with some evaporated milk and some, you know, and balance it out with a bit of sugar. And it's sort of little hole in the wall places, right, that you just drive up to and you get out and there's a big vat of this cocoa tea and they pour some out and then you have a bake on top, which is this like slightly sweetened fried dough. And it's just the most comforting, gorgeous thing you could drink. It's better than any hot chocolate I've ever had. It's got this gentle spicing to it. It's so comforting, so Moorish. And I just thought, gosh, this would do so well here. I mean, we're a cold weather country. We, you know, this hot steaming mug of spiced hot chocolate, I mean, what's not to love? So I really wanted to make sure that I featured that in the book, because for me, it was kind of surreal having something that was so iconic for St. Lucia. And, you know, it exists in other Caribbean islands as well, but not having tried it till the age of 30, it was kind of a weird moment to sort of go, gosh, this is really part of my heritage. And I think that's sort of true of sort of second generation, when your sort of grandparents are from there, but your parents maybe were born here in the UK. And I'm very concerned at the moment. It's on my mind about how do you maintain the connection when that generation starts to pass on and pass away. How do we stay connected to our heritage? And food feels like the most important way to do that, but it's becoming harder and harder. It's something me and my friends a lot of my close friends are Caribbean. We talk about it quite a lot. How do we preserve those? But, you know, putting that recipe in the book is one small way of kind of keeping that alive, I think.
It's a fascinating trip through your heritage, your own self, which is so full of so many different influences. Presumably, you're going to take that and explore it more through the other four tastes. Presumably, you finished Sweet, which comes out in February.
Yes.
Did you go on that same kind of deep dive into who you are and where you're from?
Oh, yes. In fact, probably Sweet is even more so because it's very much bringing together, firstly, my French background. My grandmother's, on my mum's side, desserts, puddings were the best. I love a British pud, so that side of me is definitely represented. But then you've got some of the more tropical flavours coming in. So I would say that the second one is almost more reflective of my heritage even than this one, but it has the same kind of ranging through different areas of the world that I've either experienced or have friends or close friends from, and that sort of thing is definitely represented. And I'm excited. That's part of the fun of this, is getting to range in this way through these different flavor profiles. It's exciting.
Thanks for listening. Do rate and review the podcast if you like it over on Apple Podcasts, and then head to my Substack to hear what else Alexina can do. I'm saying nothing, except move over, Leanna Havas.